Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 6th, 1914. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, let's start off with some emails. Dear HAC, what's with the 1914 stuff on Radio Free Northwest? Have you discovered a time machine? Signed, Francis in Indiana. No, Francis, that's kind of an inside joke. It's a rather sardonic commentary on the times we're living in, specifically a reference to the allegedly impending Israeli attack on Iran, which is going to alter the entire world situation in so many ways when we lose one-third of our imported oil because the Iranians close the Straits of Hormuz. The United States and NATO will have to send in a military expedition to try and reopen it by force, and also to protect Israel from the retaliation of Persia's surrogates, Hamas and Hezbollah. So, not only will we have the effects of the sudden petroleum shortage to deal with, we'll have another massive Middle East war on our hands, which will probably be longer and more bloody than Iraq and Afghanistan combined. My personal view is that the United States, in its present debilitated and Obamified state, just can't take that kind of 1-2 punch right now, and that these events will produce a ripple effect, which is probably about as close as we're going to get to what right-wingers have referred to for decades as the balloon going up. And of course, the white nationalist movement is not ready for the balloon to go up. As I've been screaming for 20 years, we wouldn't be ready. We've wasted almost three generations on dead ends and games playing. We're going to miss our window of opportunity because we've been too concerned with pointless and silly things that happened back in the 1990s, and because we're basically too lazy to pack the moving van and come to the land which destiny has chosen for our people's last homeland and refuge. We've spent the past 50 years waiting for a man on a white horse to ride up and flourish his saber aloft and magically bring back the world of Beaver Cleaver and the Brady Bunch and just somehow make all those black and brown faces go away. No such person has made his appearance. We needed William Wallace. What we got was Will Williams. So we're going to end up with an unspeakable mess. But that's for the future. Now, to be fair, even as we head for October, which is when Netanyahu is threatening the strike, so the U.S. government will be tied up with the election, I don't want to be a total doomsayer here. Now, I admit that there is still a chance that this may not happen. There is a fairly heavy body of opinion within the power structure itself that this won't happen, that Benjamin Netanyahu is bluffing and that he's trying to scare the United States into doing his dirty work and attacking Iran for him, which, by the by, would have the same ultimate effect. But a lot of the jabber I'm seeing in the media is of the opinion that if Israel were to chimp out and attack Persia on its own, it would upset too many wealthy and powerful people's apple carts, that it would piss off Russia and China, who need that Iranian oil more than we do. And the real movers and shakers, like George Soros, who's Jewish himself, won't let Netanyahu do it because they'd lose money. Yeah, well, prior to 1914, the received wisdom was that a general European war was impossible because all the shakers and movers in the world banking and commerce system were too interdependent on one another, and the big money people would never let it happen. And we all know how that worked out. Anyway, getting back to your question, Francis, the 1914 thing is a reference to the summer of 1914. the last summer of the old world that white men controlled and gloried in, before we all went collectively insane and plunged into World War I. Now, I know you can't draw historical parallels too far, but I think this one is appropriate. On the night that England declared war on Germany, the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, looked out of his window in Whitehall at the streetlights down below that were being blacked out in anticipation of Zeppelin raids, and he said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. They will not be lit again in my lifetime." That is, in my humble opinion, what we're going through now. As rough as things have been for the past few years for many of us, I hope you guys all enjoyed the past summer. My guess is that it will be the last so-called normal summer we have for many years, possibly even within our lifetimes. Hence the 1914 tagline on the past few Radio Free Northwests. Next email, Dear HAC, how much money would you need to hire an assistant, and do you know someone who could assume the position quickly enough? Signed, Doc from South Carolina. Okay, I'm proud to say that I've received a number of offers from some of the comrades either to foot the bill for a personal assistant for me on their own or to form some kind of a pool to hire me some help. Guys, what can I say? I'm honored and humbled that you would offer to do that. I don't like to spend too much time on internal stuff on these podcasts, believe it or not, so let me run this down for you again real quick. The problem is not one of money. The problem is one of people, of character. And the reason I don't have an assistant here is my fault, because my standards are way too high. I demand character attributes that have, for all practical purposes, become extinct in white people today. Or rather, so rare that, for all practical purposes, they are extinct. I am, in essence, hunting for a unicorn. Okay, not quite. I mean, unicorns are mythological animals. They never existed at all. The kind of white man or woman I'm looking for did exist at one time in great numbers. Hell, for 300 years, there were enough white people like that to get on leaky wooden ships and load up Conestoga wagons and settle this entire continent from sea to shining sea and build something called America. That's how many of us there used to be. But over the past century, generation after generation of white Americans, beginning with my own baby boom generation, have been so badly damaged by the Jews and the unnatural society in which we live that the alpha gene that once made us suitable for world conquest and space exploration and great art, as well as being Harold Covington's personal assistant, that gene or trait or mindset or whatever you want to call it, has been poisoned, atrophied, shriveled away and desiccated into nothingness, to be replaced by a yawning vortex of nothing but me, me, me. White people are no longer explorers or conquerors or inventors or leaders. We are consumers. Yeah, we rant and rave about everything that's wrong with us on the internet. I rant and rave about what's wrong with us on the internet. But none of that ranting and raving actually changes the fact that it is wrong. I got another email from Roberta in, well, actually, I don't know where she is. Sorry, Roberta. But she asks a very similar question. Dear HAC, you say your standards for an assistant are too strict. What are they, and why are they too strict? Why can nobody meet them? Okay, fair enough. I spend a lot of time talking about how we shouldn't do things and the kind of people we shouldn't be, so I suppose I need to talk about what we should be. Now, I warn you, though, that some of you aren't going to like this because, once again, I'm going to be holding up a mirror and you will not like what you don't see there, but maybe this is what we need to do to construct a white nationalist and Northwest version of Sergei Nechayev's Revolutionary Catechism from 19th century Russia, which I reprinted in Northwest Observer a while back. Now, to be a white nationalist or a white revolutionary of any stripe in modern-day America is the most difficult task one could possibly undertake in life. No other quote-unquote lifestyle is as vilified and assaulted by the powers that be. The government, the media, the secret police, every cultural and political institution, Hollywood, even our own friends and family members are lined up against us. Almost overwhelming pressure is exerted against us to conform, to go with the flow, to submit to the inevitable. Every day the system dumps an avalanche of deceit and abuse down on us. We're insulted and spat on by the very people for whom we are risking our lives and freedom to save. The people we wish to liberate from political tyranny and racial slavery hate us, because that's what they've been conditioned from birth to do. And they actually join forces to march against us side by side with the same reptiles who want to enslave both us and them forever. Now, this is one of the main reasons why so many movement activists don't stick around for long. They simply can't handle the day-in, day-out pressure of being a misfit and a nonconformist and not seeing anything in the way of immediate results. Americans are always on the lookout for instant gratification. Well, this movement is one place where you're not going to get that. Now, the endless barrage of insults fired at them by the system, their parents, their friends, and spouses are too much for them. They cave in and they try to crawl back to the safety and anonymity of the herd. They try to cleanse themselves of their racist sins and rejoin the world of Fast Times, debauchery, and mindless materialism, which is kind of hard to do in the middle of the Obama depression. And that's if the system will let them rejoin. My own personal observation is that it generally doesn't work out too well. Now, those who try to return to the comfort of the herd generally can never quite reconnect, not completely. Whether you like it or not, now you know, and you can't pretend that you don't know. If nothing else, you can't watch TV and miss all those Jewish names as the credits roll at the end of the show. Not only that, but our enemies have long memories, and if you've ever actually done anything that got yourself identified as a wicked and evil racist, you'll find your past popping up at the most inconvenient times for the next 50 years. Okay, I'm wandering off the subject here. What kind of man or woman would I need for my personal assistant? First off, he or she must be someone who has become involved to put something into the movement, not get something out of it. Question. While I'm thinking about it now, have I ever discussed Heil Larry syndrome with you guys? I can't remember if I did or not. Anyway, one common example of the kind of person who wants to get something out of the movement rather than put something into it are the Heil Larrys. Now, basically, these are people, often, frankly, marginal people, who are motivated out of resentment for personal wrongs, which may or may not be genuine, or reasons of pure ego, and they decide that the way to get revenge on the world that has injured and degraded them is to become the new Führer, and eventually build this big, huge, quasi-NS something or other for their own self-promotion and ego gratification, so that eventually they can see the long brown columns of stormtroopers marching down the street of their hometown shouting, Heil Larry. Okay, that's a pretty major oversimplification, but I think most of you can get the idea of what I'm trying to convey here, and if you've been in the movement for any length of time, you've probably met a few Heil Larrys. Now, I'm not going to go off on a long tangent here, but suffice it to say that my assistant cannot be a Heil Larry of any description. They can't be in it for the ego. Now, you'll notice in your white books that the oath which the Northwest Volunteers eventually swear will not be to me or to the Northwest Front, it will be to the Northwest American Republic and the Northwest Constitution. I need an assistant who gets that and understands why it has to be that way. My personal assistant needs to be knowledgeable, by which I mean politically and ideologically educated, and not necessarily somebody that I can swap obscure 14th century historical references with, although that would be nice. He or she needs a developed worldview. Now, I would obviously prefer a fellow National Socialist, but Christian Identity, or Cartoid, or National Alliance-style Yaki-ite, or Julius of Olafan, or whatever is fine, just so long as they have the basics on race and the Jews squared away in their minds. Now, this person I need must understand the concept of duty, which demands that he or she surrender all ego, all personal considerations, all hopes for the future. They must understand that we are not doing what we're doing because we expect to win. We are doing what we're doing because it is right. They must understand that Aryan man achieves his full potential only when he abandons his concern for material comfort and devotes himself to a higher ideal than his own welfare and his own desire. On a practical level, I'll try to put this as bluntly as I can. My assistant has to be prepared to spend most of the next 40 years sleeping on a mattress on the floor in a rented room, living on cheap canned goods, and buying their clothing from Goodwill, like I've spent the bulk of the last 40 years. I won't say that there's no money in the movement, but no one with the possible exception of Willis Cardo has ever gotten filthy rich. Hell, I can't think of anyone who even got as rich as the average televangelist, again, except maybe Ricardo. But there have, in fact, been a few great white leaders in the past who have managed to make a fairly good living, mostly through book and CD and now DVD peddling by mail order and online, and who have died with some property to leave behind. But you can't do that without betraying the 14 words at some point, without making compromises that cause you to become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. I never have, which is why I'm still dirt poor and I'm not sitting on some retirement estate with many rolling acres right now, bought with my supporters' money. Now, you need to understand that when you join this movement for real, one of the things you'll be giving up is money and the things that money will buy. Most Americans may say or may think that they can do that, but when it really gets down to it and they're in their second or third year of sleeping on that mattress on the floor, they change their tune. You need to think about that really carefully before you email me telling me that you want to be my right-hand man. My right hand is always going to be a pretty hard scrabble place to be. Now, you also need to understand that if you decide to dedicate yourself truly to the 14 words to make TLC, Total Life Commitment, effectively speaking, you will be more or less celibate. It's not like you're taking some kind of monastic vow when you sign on for the 14 words, and I'm not saying that marriage and relationships can't or won't happen. But again, I'm a pretty good example of why it never works. I'll say this. Judging from my emails, more and more white women have become racially aware during the Obama years. That goes hand in hand with losing one's home and job and middle class status. Downward mobility generates racism big time. So racial ideas are no longer quite the automatic turnoff on the dating scene that they once were. But the basic materialistic nature of white women hasn't changed. When you are part of this movement in a serious way, you will never have the money, the time, the personal security, the middle class status, and the toys to give American women what they have been taught all their lives to look for. I'm not saying it won't happen for you. I've seen it happen a few times, usually leading to the effective withdrawal of the white nationalist partner from the movement. Good example. I got some baby pictures the other day from a really strong and dedicated couple in Canada who are still great people, but they're no longer involved with the NF. They decided that with a child on the way and the responsibility that comes with a child, it was simply too dangerous, and I can't argue with that. I've also seen a lot of disasters, including a few of my own. So you need to be ready to deal with that fact of movement life as well. Any assistant who works with me on a daily basis must be prepared to devote his or her life to the single-minded pursuit of one goal and one goal alone, to bring the Northwest American Republic into being. This is a very single-minded style of life. There's no room for much of anything else, religion or stamp collecting or bar hopping or anything like that. The revolution is pretty much 24/7. Now, there's nothing wrong with having some fun in your political work. The word fun can be taken to mean anything that's not boring, and devoting oneself to waging war to the death against the Jew and his lackeys is anything but boring. Frankly, there have been times in the past 40 years when I have had more fun than a barrel of monkeys. Now, that much I can promise you, at least occasionally. There is also a deep satisfaction in this work, which is hard for me to describe. The knowledge that you are, in fact, part of the solution. Whenever you see a race-mixed couple in the grocery store, you know in your own mind that you're involved in the long-term process of doing something about it, and that keeps you from stressing out and popping a blood vessel, or alternatively, flipping out with a gun or something else that would destroy your life and your effectiveness. There is no way to quantify how many lives have been saved from white men flipping out with a semi-auto and going on a shooting spree because of their movement involvement. Because they knew for a fact that they were part of the solution, and that gave them the strength to control their perfectly justifiable rage and hatred. But I can think of a few examples myself, so yes, that's one plus to serving the 14 words. Now, I am rambling totally off the question here, and it's time for a music break. Roberta, let me think a bit more about this, okay, and I'll try to get back to it later in the broadcast. In the meantime, this is Rita Connolly from the Granuala album, which is kind of an operatic story about the life of one of history's few real warrior women, the Irish pirate queen Grace O'Malley.
Ripples in the water of the rock pool sun, ripples in the water of the rock pool sun, ripples in the water of the rock pool sun, and the boats are in for winter. Donalon Cogie, will you marry me? Donalon Cogie, will you marry me? Donalon Cogie, will you marry me? Will I carry your three children?
Ripple. ripples in the rock pools, ripples in the sea, ripples in the sand dunes, rolling into Connemara. Ripples in the rock pools, ripples in the sea, ripples in the sand dunes, rolling into Connemara.
Will you sail with me, Donal an Cogy? Will you sail with me from here to Faquarana?
I can feel the tide falling in the rain. I can feel the tide falling in the rain. I can feel the tide falling in the rain, but the wind is surely rising.
Ripples in the rock pools, ripples in the sea, ripples in the sand dunes, rolling into Connemara. Ripples in the rock pools, ripples in the sea, ripples in the sand dunes, rolling into Connemara.
I can feel the tide falling in the rain. I can feel the tide falling in the rain, but the wind is surely rising. Donal an Cogy, you will come to no good. Donal an Cogy, you will come to no good. Donal an Cogy, you will come to no good. I shall leave you and take my dowry.
Ripples in the rock pools, ripples in the sea, ripples in the sand dunes, rolling into Connemara. Ripples in the rock pools, ripples in the sea, ripples in the sand dunes, rolling into Connemara.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who had previously been inserted into Steele's home, posing as a handyman to spy on the Steele family, before any of this came up. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of gold and silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that gold and silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. These appeared, even to a layman who first heard them, to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points, words, and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts, who were prepared to testify that the tapes were fraudulent, were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender, was a raging alcoholic who at the same time was being sued by two members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money, and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that the second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. His performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained either to Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed somebody off real bad, although I don't see how. Ed had withdrawn from the Idaho governor's race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is being held in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in the health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. It is time that Edgar Steele's voice was heard once again in the land, if for no other reason than because the FBI and the Obama regime do not want you to hear it. This recording is from 2009.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's March 25, 2009, and tonight's Nickel Rant is entitled, "We're All Terrorists Now." We've come through the looking glass. On this side, however, is Wonderland with a decidedly Orwellian twist. The Red Queen has morphed into a Marxist president. Still red, still in charge, though. The Mad Hatter is Little Timmy Geithner, wannabe Treasury Czar of the world, whose Tea Party is hosted on Wall Street while other Tea Parties are convened by patriots throughout America in response. The maddening Cheshire Cat is our media, with that smile conveying nothing but misdirection and gibberish. "Some are more equal than others," said Orwell through his piggy little Animal Farm overseer. "We know who are the others. Thee and me, of course." For extra points, guess who are the "some" of whom Orwell wrote. "We're painting the roses red," sang the playing card soldiers when asked by Alice why they were drenching all the white roses in the kingdom with bright red paint. All the minions of the new administration are busy repainting roses throughout America just now. However, as observed by Shakespeare, what is in a name? A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Bush's policies still are the same, regardless of the spin now being accorded them by the Obamatrons. We're still in Iraq. Gitmo still is in business. America's southern border still is wide open. The Bush bailouts continue unabated, but now are on Obama steroids. It's enough to make your head spin, isn't it? Each week brings a fresh batch of outrageous events and news items that further marginalize an ever-growing percentage of Americans. Last week brought a bumper crop headed by an incredible document leaked by someone in the Missouri police bureaucracy entitled "The Modern Militia Movement." The Missouri Information Analysis Center, or MIAC, document popped up on Alex Jones's website and promptly sent shockwaves throughout the patriot community. Have you ever supported in any way Republican Ron Paul of Texas? How about last year's Libertarian Party presidential candidate, Bob Barr, or the Constitution Party's presidential candidate, Chuck Baldwin? According to MIAC, you are a militia-influenced terrorist. Yep, you heard me right. You're a terrorist. Look, I couldn't just make up stuff as outlandish as this sort of thing. Truth continues to be stranger than fiction. We're painting the roses red. Better go scrape that bumper sticker off your car, because MIAC specifically identifies it as evidence that you should be watched and approached with caution. MIAC is just one of 58 fusion centers funded throughout America by the Federal Department of Homeland Security, with over $250 million, tasked with identifying potential trends or patterns of terrorist or criminal operations. This per the MIAC website. Are you opposed to the coming North American Union, NAU, whereby America is subsumed within a new government encompassing all of North America? How about the New World Order, the NWO, whereby America surrenders her constitution altogether in favor of becoming just another cog in a world government? Speak out against either the NAU or the NWO in any way, and you're a terrorist, says MIAC, courtesy of your tax dollars spent in its support. Of course, the MIAC report is nothing new. During the Clinton administration, the FBI issued a document identifying defenders of the U.S. Constitution as right-wing extremists to be watched as being potential terrorists. Are you opposed to illegal immigration? According to MIAC, you're a terrorist. Libertarians and constitutionalists are racists, which might cause some consternation at the headquarters of my own state's Idaho Constitution Party, since its chairman is a black man, Paul Venable, who I intend to ask how he feels about MIAC's outlandish characterization. Those who follow my writing and ranting know full well that I'm a big supporter of the Constitution Party. Are you opposed to abortion? Terrorist. Do you fly an American flag? Terrorist. Opposed to gun confiscation? Yep, terrorist. Opposed to the expansion of federal power at the expense of state jurisdiction? Terrorist. Are you concerned that Obama might put through a mandatory universal service program, which has just been announced, incidentally? If so, you're a terrorist. Do you oppose the convening of a constitutional convention, which now is demanded by 32 of the 34 states necessary to force its being convened? Because you fear the further eroding or even eradication of the First and or Second Amendments? If so, you're a terrorist. Offered the chance to denounce MIAC, or at least explain it away, Missouri's Governor Jay Nixon unequivocally supported and defended it, stating, "Any way they take that information and can analyze what the threat levels are is important to make sure the public stays safe. It's for the children, in other words." So, now we have descended all the way into George Orwell's 1984. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. Be anything but a full-on supporter of the Democrat agenda, and you're a terrorist. Even Republicans now are suspect. Witness Ron Paul's status in Missouri, courtesy of federal tax dollar support. I sure was glad to see George W. Bush go, but the hair on the back of my neck is beginning to stand up now. And so should yours. It no longer matters, so I might as well fess up. I fly an American flag in my front yard. I believe in the Constitution. I have voted straight Constitution Party since it dropped its taxpayer party name. I am strongly opposed to gun legislation of every stripe. I oppose illegal immigration and want all of them thrown back into Mexico, anchor babies and all. I strongly oppose the NAU, NWO, NAFTA, WTO, and GATT. I believe in the U.S. Constitution and have repeatedly taken oaths, military and bar admission, to defend it from enemies, both foreign and domestic. In Missouri, I am a terrorist. According to the feds, until they denounced MIAC and cut off its funding, I am a terrorist. If you are reading or listening to these words, almost certainly you are a terrorist too. They make it harder and harder every day to keep from thinking in terms of the government as our enemy, don't they? You want to see real terrorists? How about those who willingly plunder the future of our children and their children for their own financial gain? What about a government that invades small countries on a lie and kills millions of their citizens? What about a government that tortures even its own citizens? What about a government that takes your retirement funds and gives them to illegal aliens? What about a government that encourages your employer to send your job overseas? To me, these are the very definitions of terrorism, folks. I call the perpetrators of all these things terrorists. Terrorists who cause many of us now to lie awake nights, sweating how we're going to take care of our families or make do in our old age. We're all terrorists now, and they have the unmitigated gall to call us terrorists. Well, I guess that we all are terrorists now. Some say that patriotism is old-fashioned. Some think that love of country is out of date. Some consider the slightest show of sentiment towards one's flag to be naive. But God help us, and God help our country, if the cynics, the one-worlders, the Zionist, neoconservative, intellectual dilettantes ever persuade us that these things have passed us by. Because, ladies and gentlemen, patriotism, loyalty, sentiment, these things are the United States of America. In my lifetime, I've seen America grow and change. I've seen her stand tall, and I've seen her brought low. I've seen the best that America can be, and recently, I've seen the worst that America can be. But always, she has been my America, our America, and she will be our America, come what may, for better or worse. We have a habit here in America of forgetting what a grand and noble experiment she represented when our founding fathers wrote the Declaration of Independence and, then, the Constitution. We forget the sacrifices they made in property, in family, and finally in their own blood. We forget the sacrifices by all those since that time. Sacrifices made so that we might have the freedom to come together like this and discuss change. Well, I submit that the time has come for change. Real change. Real change that we can believe in, not the phony campaign promises made by Barack Obama to get elected. New America. An idea whose time has come. My name is Edgar J. Steele, and thanks for listening.
This is Cordelia's Dad.
Never will return. A wager, and I will go with you away to the May blooming field. A maiden, I will go to the Bloomfield Hill, and a maiden, I will return. So away went this young man. Wager for to win away to the May blooming field. He sat himself down by the clear flowing stream, and he fell fast asleep on the bank. Nine times she walked around the crown of his head, and nine times she walked round his feet. Nine times she kissed his red ruby lips as he lay on the bank fast asleep. She wore on her little finger, the same did she place on his own, that it might be a token of her love to him, that she had been there and was gone. If I was awake as I was asleep, this maiden she never would have fled. It's her I would have killed, her blood I would have spilled, and the birds told the story of the dead. Oh, hard-hearted young man, hard-hearted youth, your heart's as hard as any stone, for to think to kill one who had loved you so long, and weep for the grave you lie in.
I got a very good reception to last week's piece on the Battle of Maldon, and so here's some more Viking stuff from my Weird Aryan History series. Over 1,000 years ago, around 985 AD, the Viking Eric the Red sailed westward while he was exiled from his Iceland home for homicide. He returned to Iceland with fabulous tales of pastures and valuable wild animals in a land that he named Greenland. 25 boats with some 500 people are said to have returned with him, eventually building 2 settlements on the Big Island, with typical Norse longhouses and enclosed barns, etc., made out of fitted stone, many of which still stand today and some of which are actually still in use. The exact details are lost to history, but the outlines of this story have been proven true by archaeologists in this century who have excavated Viking remains at 2 sites on Greenland's west coast. It needs to be borne in mind that the period of Norse settlement was prior to the Little Ice Age, which set in around the beginning of the 14th century, and that in the days of the first Scandinavian settlements, the climate was much warmer even than it is today. Grapes grew in England in those days, and Greenland most likely really was green. The climate was milder, and crops could be grown as well as the abundant animal life hunted. Greenland's 2 outposts together, called the Eastern Settlement and the Western Settlement, had about 2,500 inhabitants at their peak. For more than 400 years, they lived primarily on meat and milk from sheep and goats and cows. Now, interestingly, for those of us who envision Vikings constantly quaffing ale and mead and whatnot, they had no beer or ale, and they had to trade for it. What grain was available was far too precious for fermenting and had to be used for food. For wood and iron implements, they traded polar bear and caribou skins and walrus hides and tusks. The Greenlanders launched at least 1 expedition to North America, landing in the country they called Vinland, which seems to have been in modern-day Newfoundland, and they set up a short-lived colony there. But for a variety of reasons, probably including the devastation of the Black Plague in Europe and a waning interest in Greenland's luxury products, the settlements lost touch with the old country. A recent studies of ice cores from Greenland showed that the 15th century, when the colonies probably died out, was a period of climate deterioration across the Atlantic. When the Little Ice Age set in around the beginning of 1300, the ice flows from the Arctic pressed in, and the sailing season in the Northern Hemisphere became much shorter, and the seas became more unnavigable and dangerous. Trade and communication with Greenland dropped away, but historical researchers say that their explanation has to be more nuanced than simply it got cold and they died. For starters, that wouldn't explain why the Eskimos survived those lean years. Now, it's been proven that human beings, including white men, can, if necessary, survive and even thrive on an all-meat, high-protein diet, as witness the Atkins diet craze. But beyond this, for reasons which have always remained mysterious, people in Europe seem simply to have forgotten about Greenland. Various popes used to agitate their Norwegian bishops to send out priests to the colonies, but it seems that volunteers to go off into the far reaches of the earth were kind of scarce, and Norwegian church fathers seem to have grown quite adept at avoiding or obfuscating the subject. One gets the impression that they just couldn't be bothered. At one stage, Greenland falcons were very fashionable among the nobility, but the fashion seems to have changed, and as far as Europe was concerned, Greenland just kind of fell off the edge of the earth. The last known record of the Greenland Vikings was in 1408, when a traveler reported a wedding there. Several centuries later, in 1721, Hans Egede, a Norwegian-born missionary, sought out the colonies. To his surprise, they were gone, and this seems to have been the first time anyone noticed that they were gone. It's a mystery that remains unsolved to this day. There is one fascinating story, though, which I have to quote from memory since it's been years since I read this. Greenland was actually rediscovered independently by the English sailors John and Sebastian Cabot in the late 15th century. And sometime in the 16th century, the great Elizabethan sailor and first Arctic explorer Martin Frobisher first arrived. Frobisher recorded in his log that as he and his men came ashore on the rocky beach, they found a dead white man lying there face down, wearing only furs, who had apparently only just died of unknown causes. They buried him, and they went on to find an empty settlement of stone huts. Did Frobisher and the modern world just miss the last of the Greenlanders by a few hours? Researchers and history buffs have offered many possible explanations for the disappearance of the Greenland Vikings, including raids by Eskimos or European pirates, assimilation into Eskimo communities, and starvation, so forth and so on. The modern DNA testing shows no apparently genetic Norse strain in modern Greenland Inuit, though. Neither do the settlement remains show any signs of fire or violence or destruction, although those wouldn't necessarily be present after all that time. From the Greenlanders' point of view, one day the ships just stopped coming. Archaeological excavations, which have been carried out in recent years on grave tumuli, which still dot the rocky hillsides, show evidence of physical degeneration due to poor nutrition and inbreeding. The last Greenlanders seem to have been dwarf-like people, sick and often deformed, who dressed in uncured skins, had no metal tools, and who could not have fought off the Eskimos. Ever want a chill down your spine? Envision what life in the Greenland settlements must have been like during the last 50 years or so before the end. Completely isolated at the end of the world, always cold and probably starving, always looking to the east over the icy water for the ships that never came. Tell you what, that's kind of a depressing story, so what I'll do is I'll tack on another short Viking-related piece from my Weird Aryan History series. I'll tell you guys about the Kensington Runestone, which was discovered in November of 1898 on a farm near Kensington, Minnesota. The Kensington Runestone is a slab of gray wax stone, gray in color, measuring 36 inches long, 16 inches wide, and 6 inches thick. It contains runic writing along the face of the stone and along one edge. The stone was found on the property of Olaf Oman back in 1898, who was a Swedish immigrant. But Minnesota was full of Scandinavians at that point in our history, just like Wisconsin was full of Germans. On November the 8th, 1898, Olaf Oman, several of his sons, and some men from neighboring farms were clearing lumber and pulling stumps in preparation for plowing. Oman was having considerable difficulty digging one tree, a poplar estimated to be between 10 and 40 years old, which was on the southern slope of a 50-foot knoll between his farm and that of Nils Flotten, Oman's closest neighbor. When the tree was finally uprooted, the cause of Oman's trouble came into view. Entwined in the roots of the tree was a 200-pound slab of graywack, the Kensington Runestone. The roots of the tree, especially the largest root, were flattened by contact with the stone, as was noted by several people who were there, and by later visitors to the site. The stone was found face down in the soil, about 6 inches below ground level. Now, on finding the stone, Mr. Oman and his sons noted the runic letters, but they couldn't decipher them. For a while, the stone was used as a doorstep for Mr. Oman's granary, until some local historian type saw it one day and realized what he was looking at. The stone was thereafter examined by many runic scholars, who discovered that the runes claimed to be an account of Norse explorers in the 14th century. There has been controversy ever since regarding the Kensington Stone, with some scholars claiming it's a forgery and some claiming it's genuine. The inscription is in two parts. The portion on the face of the stone says, quote-unquote, 8 Goths and 22 Norwegians on a journey of exploration from Vinland very far west. We had camped by 2 rocky islands 1 day's journey north from this stone. We were out fishing one day. After we came home, we found 10 men red with blood and dead. AVM save from evil. The portion along the edge of the stone says, have 10 men by the sea to look after our ships 14 days journey from this island. Year 1362. The AVM would probably stand for Ave Maria, since Scandinavia was Christianized by this time. The inscription, if genuine, would be one of the longest ancient runic inscriptions in the world. It is certainly one of the most controversial. Back in 1907, a young scholar named Hjalmar R. Holand purchased the stone from Mr. Oman and began to promote it, giving speeches and writing books about the stone. He also wrote about Viking settlements in America and the Holy Mission, as he called it, of Bishop Paul Knutsen, a medieval Swedish missionary whose expedition supposedly left the stone behind. Knutsen definitely existed, and he was supposed to have sailed across the seas, evangelizing for Christ, so forth and so on, but the details in the old chronicles are sketchy, and there's no proof on the European end that Knutsen ever visited Vinland. The monastic legend is as follows. A Swedish bishop named Paul Knutsen was sent in 1354 by King Magnus Eriksson of Sweden and Norway to discover why settlements in Greenland were disappearing and to bring some pagans into the Catholic fold. Arriving in Greenland, Knutsen found nothing but a few cattle, no settlement, and no people. Okay, that's possible, although like I mentioned earlier, the last official record of Greenland settlers that is accepted as authentic is dated 1408, which is 50 years after Knutsen's expedition. But Greenland is a huge place, and maybe Knutsen simply couldn't find the last Greenland settlements because he wasn't looking in the right place. Now, here's where it gets kind of hazy. Supposedly, the mission then continued westward to Vinland, i.e. Newfoundland, and west from Vinland, entering the Hudson Bay and traveling up the Nelson River and the Red River into Minnesota, then down the Buffalo River to establish a camp at Lake Cormorant. The party was attacked by Indians at that site. The remnants of the party then fled south and carved the runestone on the island, quote-unquote, where it was discovered by Farmer Oman. Knutsen himself never returned to Norway, although seven men, including the navigator, an Englishman named Nicholas of Lynn, are claimed to have made it back to Europe, which is why we allegedly know all this stuff. Are there other runestones in America? Well, there's many claims of other runestones, along with assorted relics and mooring holes found in areas of Minnesota, Iowa, and South Dakota, lending evidence to the idea that there were significant Norse incursions into the continent. The relics include halberds, battle axes, spears, and boat hooks. Many of these relics have been claimed by critics to be modern items mistaken for ancient relics, although some, like the so-called Beardmore relics, are known to be ancient. But the explanologists claim that they were planted in order to fool the gullible. The mooring holes are a different story, however. Now, mooring holes are holes in large boulders into which the Vikings would drop a peg attached to the ship to anchor it to the shore. More than 200 such holes have been found from South Dakota to Michigan. And if you accept them as evidence, then they show that there was a significant Viking presence in North America from about 1000 AD to 1400. Critics argue that the holes were drilled by modern folks for blasting, but others argue, who would go to the trouble of drilling a blasting hole and then not blast it? Also, drilled holes are round with V-shaped bottoms. The mooring holes are rounded triangles with U-shaped bottoms. For most of 1948, the Kensington Stone was on exhibit at the Smithsonian Institution, where the curator and director publicly praised it as, quote-unquote, probably the most important archaeological object yet found in North America. The stone was returned to Minnesota in March of 1949 to be unveiled in St. Paul in honor of the state's centennial, and it now has its own museum in Alexandria, Minnesota. No one has ever been able to prove, one way or the other, whether or not the Kensington Stone is authentic. But there can be no doubt that the Norse people of the Dark Ages and the early Middle Ages were formidable seafarers and explorers. There's archaeological evidence that in addition to Greenland and Vinland, they also sailed as far as the west coast of Africa and the Canary and Azore Islands. As I said last week, the Viking era of our race's history is in fact a comparatively short one, but there is no question that it was a time of achievement and glory that will never be forgotten so long as any white man is alive anywhere. That, by the way, was Scotland's greatest tenor, the late Kenneth MacKellar. Now, I promised I'd get back to Roberta's email from the first part of the show when she asked exactly what my requirements were for my personal assistant that I don't have and am not likely to get. I think I need to make it clear that I'm not actually advertising for it like it was a job opening. I've said before that this is something that's way too important for some internet walk-in to take on, for a variety of reasons that should be obvious, starting with the fact that if I were to advertise such a position, like a Help Wanted ad, at least half of the people who applied would be FBI informants. The individual I'll get for my personal assistant someday, and then of the kind that I'll get more of to staff a proper party headquarters, is the same kind of man or woman that we need here for the whole revolutionary process. A political soldier. The first of the Northwest Volunteers. I'm still convinced that somewhere out there, there remain at least a couple of thousand white people of both genders who still have the old alpha gene that once made our people great. White people who are in the right age range. Not so young as to still be Beavis and Butthead flaky, but not so old as to be dribbling or moving with a walker. Now that's what will make these new comrades really hard to find. White people seem to take so long to learn wisdom these days. Our best people are in their 50s and 60s. Sometimes I ask some of them, where the hell were you when you were 25 and young enough to assume a leadership role in all this? Now it's like we all have to go through the whole gamut of the American experience, the bad marriages and divorces and the lost jobs and the lost houses and the bankruptcies and the brushes with the law and the failed dreams as the American crap machine just churns out the turds right onto your head like you're standing under a fecal waterfall. On and on and on until one day about age 43 or 44, your average dumbass American honky suddenly snaps awake and says, this ain't right. Why ain't this right? What's going on, Mr. Wizard? You catch them then, you can take them aside and explain to them, my friend, let me tell you what a Jew is. But why the hell can't that happen in these people's 20s? Sorry, I'm babbling again. Rather than me go off on yet another long tirade, saying things I've already said before, in order to describe the kind of person we're going to need here in the Northwest, let me tell you a little story. I presume that most of you have at least some idea of what lemmings are. They're small wild rodents in Norway and Lapland who breed very rapidly, and so every 6 or 7 years or so, when the population gets too large for the food supply, they come together in a huge horde and they migrate away, sometimes throwing themselves over cliffs or into rivers and committing mass suicide in the process, although scientific opinion now holds that they don't do this intentionally. But that's the lemming legend, so to speak. Anyway, one day a tourist was out hiking in northern Norway, and he sat down on a rock to rest, looking out over the fjord, and after a while a lemming came up and sat down beside him. Hello, said the tourist. Hello, said the lemming. Hey, you can talk, said the tourist, and so they conversed for a while about the weather and caribou and sports and whatnot. And then the tourist said, you know, I've always wanted to meet a lemming who could talk, because there's something I've always wanted to ask you guys. Sure, go ahead, says the lemming. Well, you know when you guys get together in big, huge armies of hundreds of thousands of millions of you, and then you all go running down to the cliffs, and you run headlong over the cliffs into the sea and commit mass suicide? I've often wondered why you lemmings do that. That's funny, said the lemming. I've always wondered why you humans don't. Sometimes when we white nationalists try to speak to the muggles and lemmings of our own kind, those who are not racially aware, the conversation is about as pointless as that. They are in the process of committing collective suicide, genocide against their own species, and they honestly can't understand why we don't join them. The true white nationalist or national socialist is just as mystified by them. I simply cannot imagine in my own mind how it is possible for any white man or woman to live in this society and to see and hear and know the same things that I do and not draw the same conclusions. I can't wrap my mind around it. To me, the truth of our worldview is so obvious that arguing against it is like trying to tell me the sun rises in the west every morning. Now you can come up with all the convoluted arguments and polemics you want and all the graphs and charts and phony statistics, but the liberal and politically correct point of view just plain isn't true. Or let me correct that. Lies are not a point of view, and nothing a liberal says can make these things true. On the other hand, niggers are not equal. buggery is not all right. Jews are evil. White people are superior. These things are just plain true. And not one single thing that this government or its liberals or its Jews or its FBI can say or do to me or anyone else will ever make these things true. Now, you want to know what kind of political soldiers will win us the Northwest Republic? The people who understand what I just said without any further explanation. You feel me, like the niggers say? Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.